The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
In 5, 4, 3. Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology-themed podcast. I'm one of your hosts for the week, Michael Scavarla with Penn State University.
I'm one of your other hosts, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
And I'm your third host. I'm Jody Green at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
You almost didn't remember where you worked.
Yeah, because I'm actually not at the university. So that's not even true. I'm in Douglas County. I'm in Omaha. I work for Nebraska Extension.
And we've got a special guest today. Special guest, could you introduce yourself?
I would be so happy to. My name is Dr. Ainsley Sego. I am the Associate Curator of Invertebrate Zoology at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in scenic Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I study beetles.
Well, thank you, Ainsley, for coming on today. I think Pittsburgh is very scenic, having grown up there.
I was going to say, you scored big points with Mike saying that.
I know. I love my former hometown.
So. You love steel tower mills and the Steelers.
Yeah, I grew up in a part of the Pacific Northwest that was also sort of a decaying post-industrial metropolis that was being taken over by forest called Tacoma, Washington, that was also notorious for smelling really bad. And frankly, I feel like I've come home.
Wait, does Pittsburgh smell like?
Oh, a variety of things, but there's kind of a sulfurous egg fart scent that you get on certain special mornings.
Oh, that's what that was when I lived with Mike.
I think that might have been Mike. I don't know.
I don't even know how to recover from that, so I'm just going to ignore it and move on. Ainsley, you were one of John's first guests back in 2015. It seems, I can't believe we've been doing this
roughly
podcast
a thousand years ago. Yeah, exactly.
Like, we're coming towards the heat death of the universe now since you've been on last. Back in episode 8, if the listeners want to go listen to your first interview. And you've done a lot since then. And like you mentioned, you're a museum curator, and we haven't had anybody from the museum space on the show before. So I wanted to bring you on for that, and we'll get to museum stuff. But for the listeners that have been with us the whole time, could you maybe fill us in on what you've been doing since 2015, where you've been, what you've been up to, and how you came to land at the Carnegie?
Sure thing. So in 2015, I was just transitioning from my sixth year of postdoctoral research at the Australian National Insect Collection to becoming a collection manager for the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries, managing their biosecurity collection. And that turned out to actually secretly be a diagnostics and extension job. And I loved diagnostics. It was so good for me. I'm still a beetle purist and will continue to insist that beetles are the best and coolest insects. But it actually forced me to learn how to identify other insects as well. Things like white flies and scales, aphids. Aphids, I hate them. I have a lot of words about aphids that I could share, but spotted winged Drosophila, things, even beetles that I had previously been able to escape, things like bark beetles, the scolitids. I've got a framed scolitid up there from one of the wood volumes on my wall. And it was incredible for growth as a insect systematist, taxonomist, diagnostician, general entomologist, just having to identify literally anything that comes in the mail. Got no idea. I didn't know about, you know, psyllids, plant hoppers, triosids before. Well, that's my problem now. Got no idea. And that's actually turned out to serve me really well in my current position too.
So how does that compare to like the USDA here? Because I know we've got a gazillion identifiers. Like the lab I did my postdoc in, my boss just did aphids for the USDA. Like all the aphids came to him. There was a mite guy, Ron Ochoa, that you might know, just down the hallway. Like he did all the mites, but you did everything. So was it
We had a mic guy. We had a wonderful mic guy. Her name was Danuta, and she was a lovely Polish woman who was an Areophyid mite taxonomist. Ew. It's really important to have a mic guy of any gender.
That's a genderless term.
It's important to have a mic guy because when you're trying to identify things like scale insects and white flies, and the key says quinquilocular pores on it, you could go to the mite person who has the best microscope and get them to show you how to identify a quinquilocular pore and what level of magnification you need to be able to see that. So that was really a blessing for me. My team in New South Wales was me, a white fly taxonomist who is in the administration position, a mycologist, our mite guy or mite lady, and then a team of technicians that helped us out with making slide mounts, with doing some of the paperwork, not all of it, and running our DNA lab. So it was just a little kind of diagnostic service that maintained this big collection of things that are relevant for biosecurity. And that's something that I got asked about when I moved here a lot, because in Australia, biosecurity is really a very common term. And it just means pests, insect pests. It means native insect pests. It means invasive insect pests. It means things that are changing due to climate change. It's just keeping stuff safe from bug-related problems. Biosecurity. It also applies to plant disease, like we would call it pathology here, I guess. And so it's very, very comparable to USDA and quarantine work, I would say.
Okay, cool. And so you did that for a number of years and started at Carnegie in 2020?
2020, which was a chill time to move across the world and start a new job at a new place where you can't meet anybody and you're not allowed to have more than two people in the same room and you got to have masks on and all the meetings are remote. So that was an adventure. But we're back to virtually normal now, insofar as literally any of us can be described as normal. I applied for this job on a whim because we were living in Australia and I was kind of tired of my kid growing up, not seeing his extended family more than once a year, since they're all back in the States. So we moved here and I applied for two positions here. I applied for as a collection manager and as a curator, and they hired me as a curator. The previous curator is a lepidopterist, Dr. John Rollins, who worked on colorful day flying tiger moth kind of things. And so he was the curator here from the early 1980s through about 2018, 2019. So his long, brutal reign of Lepidoptera terror has come to an end, and I'm pleased to report that the age of beetles has finally begun.
Just in time. We were all waiting for it.
So as a curator, what exactly do you do, and how does your specialty, your love for beetles, how will that change the museum there?
All moths in the dumpster. No. There is one of the other coleopterists here in our section. We have about 5 or 6 permanent staff who each have their own little kind of area of expertise. We have a curator of crustacea, but one of the other coleopterists who does all of our USDA contract scalated identification is a kind of a beetle chauvinist like me, who suggested that we should go through and simply cut off half of the wings of all of the Lepidoptera to create a more efficient use of space. And obviously that suggestion has been ignored for a long time, but I like to think we have a friendly rivalry, we beetle and lep people. This collection has always been predominantly beetles and leps. We have a few other things, but a lot of our holdings, like things like Orthoptera, I believe, were shipped off to the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philly. They've had a couple of big faunistic exchanges over the years where they give us all the carabids and we give them all of our, you know, unwanted aphids or whatever. And so I kind of like that approach to running a museum, but as a curator, it's kind of like being a PI. You apply for grants, you glad hand luminaries and donors and potential donors. You get to give public talks, you do a lot of tours, you supervise students and interns and work studies and volunteers. You do some research when you get the time. We have two collection managers who are in charge of managing loans, which is a big job. They also do their own research as well. So this museum really punches above its weight, and I'm just delighted to be here. It's kind of, you have to be a jack of all trades in this position. Well, it's not a huge museum. I'm going to be painting some crustaceans later because we're trying to build a display of non-insect arthropods for our updated insect hallway. And no one's ever done that here before. And so all we have is a bunch of like really sad, desiccated, absolutely bleached white crabs and stomatopods and crayfish. And someone is going to have to make them look beautiful. And that's going to be me. So I'm going to paint some crabs.
That sounds like fun. Sounds almost therapeutic.
We'll see. It's simultaneously therapeutic and a chance to just really ruin a crab.
Okay. So, other luminary, other arthropods, non-insect arthropods? You're going to have some giant isopods, perchance?
I wish we had a giant isopod. According to our crustacean curator, we used to have a lobster named Jumbo who was dead, but he was in a really big jar. And he was part of our sort of, you know, outreach display down in the public area. And when they rearranged the layout of the ground floor of the museum, Jumbo the lobster disappeared and hasn't been seen since. So somewhere in this museum, there is a missing lobster the size of a human baby. Someday we'll find that. But we've got amblypygids, we've got horseshoe crabs, we've got, you know, regular sized isopods, scorpions, pseudoscorpions, everything you could want, you know. We only had one sulfugid and it was pinned upside down and pretty desiccated. So I'm not gonna put the sulfugid in that display. But it's just a matter of finding a bunch of weird old stuff that will be appropriate for a dry mounted exhibition on public display and putting it out there.
What are you going to paint them with? Like what kind of paint? And
I actually connected with a wonderful fellow entomologist at the British Museum on Twitter. She had posted about their process of painting crustaceans for their crustacean exhibit. And you coat them with, you coat them with something called butvar. It's a butanol varnish. It's basically a resin that you dissolve in alcohol and paint over the surface of your specimen. And it's commonly used in, it turns out, in vertebrate paleontology. If you have a really crumbly, like sandy fossil that's going to like crumble or flake apart, you coat it with butvar and it holds the whole thing together. This is also the base coat you're supposed to use in your crustaceans before you paint them with an acrylic-based paint. So I've got a whole protocol for it now. So if you need to paint a crustacean, there's a way to do it.
And are you going to tweet all your process, right?
Absolutely. It's wild. That's one of my favorite things. Like, I don't know what's going to happen with Twitter, but I just love it because when I'm walking around in the museum and I find some weird, inexplicable little, God knows what, like tiny jar of weird beetles or suppository sized gel capsule full of tenebrionids and bustrichids. Like, who is going to enjoy this as much as I am? I can think of like four people and they're all on Twitter. And so that's why I like to share that stuff with the world.
Yeah. So listeners, if you do not follow American Beetles, you need to do that. I've not been on Twitter because I didn't know what was going on. I was not getting anything cool for a really long time. And then I had to like block Elon Musk, I think. Is that what I had to do to get back my Ento Twitter? I have no idea.
I mean, you're definitely on a list now that you blocked.
Probably. Because I was like, why are you tweet? Like, why am I only getting...
Why am I getting morning missives from Elon Musk?
I just would leave and I wasn't looking at anything great. And then after that, I was like, oh, Ento Twitter's back.
Well, it's as insofar as Twitter continues to exist. A lot of people have migrated to Mastodon. I created an account like 4 months ago and haven't been able to log in because it won't send me a password reset email. So I bet they're having a great time on Mastodon, but I wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. For social media addicts, Tumblr is also still out there. And there's a lot of people who are posting absolutely gorgeous insect photos and just shots from stuff they see in their daily work on Tumblr.
This actually makes me think of a question I had for you. It wasn't on Mike's list, but I was curious if you were still active on Tumblr. I had listed your Tumblr before back in 2015. I just went back through and I found you again. And it looks like lots of cool stuff is being posted on there. So yeah, everybody should Tumblr. Everybody should go check it out. What's your Tumblr called?
My Tumblr is called Beetles Ink, as in ink, the kind you put in a pen, and or Beetles Ink, depending on how you want to spell it. And I guess it's just going to be an extension of Twitter, which is just sometimes it's going to be cartoons that I drew and sometimes it's going to be pictures of weird books that I found.
Mike, can I steal more of the time?
Yeah.
Oh, because I also wanted to ask about the cartooning. That was originally way back when I was quite enamored with the cartoons you were posting on Twitter. And I thought it was amazing that there was a bug person that was drawing and posting art, and just thought you were like the coolest person I was ever going to get on my podcast. Are you still cartooning? Are you still publishing? At the time when we first met, you had a book out on Comixology, nonetheless. I see on your Amazon page that maybe you've published some more since then. Are those some things you'd be willing to share?
I have an Amazon page. That's horrifying. I've done a couple of anthologies that my friend Spike, who's a comics publisher out of Chicago, runs.
Some of her stuff.
I am under contract with her to produce a kids graphic novel about bugs, which I'm working on incredibly slowly, but I'm working on it. I'm very excited. The main challenge is that it was going to be called Bug Boy, because it's about a boy who gets bug powers. And it turns out that Bug Boys is the title of a really successful graphic novel series by a cartoonist named Laura Netzger, which is about a pair of adorable little scarab beetles that run around and have little cartoon adventures. So thinking of a different title is going to be a challenge, but that's something that I'm working on slowly, but I'm really excited about it. I gave that away. I need to order a new copy of my book with Kip Will, Bombo's Big Question, about a bombardier beetle who wants to know how bombardier beetles evolved. That was produced as part of the Broader Impacts for an NSF grant. That was actually the most fun that I've ever had doing Broader Impacts. So that was a great project. He wrote it with a student. I helped edit it, and then I did all of the illustrations for it. And it really gets very deep into the instructions on how to do that. The PDF of that is actually available for free online if people want. And I can send you guys a link if you have show notes or anything like that that you want to put it into. But yeah, so I still draw lots of cartoons for fun. I draw stuff that I'm drawing some stuff right now that is going to go hopefully out in the hallway as part of our exhibit, explaining how, what goes on behind the scenes at an insect collection or in a natural history museum. Because what people see in the public side of the museum, they think, oh, this is what a museum is. And it's the tip of the iceberg. It's the teeniest, tiniest little, it's the respiratory spiracle of the botfly larva of science that's buried beneath the flesh of the museum, right? There's so, sorry, that wasn't appropriate, but there's so much going on. There's so much cool stuff happening here. We have so much material. We have stuff going back to the 1850s. And there is research, there's specimens, there's secrets, there's sordid tales. There's so much here that you would never, ever know about. And I'm trying to come up with a couple of ways that we can sort of communicate that in a cute, friendly fashion to museum visitors out in the public spaces.
I would love to read that comic book.
It's fun. And then I have my coloring book. I think I had put this out when I talked to you guys last, Your Parasitic Pals, which is just my little device. Jody, did I send you some PDFs?
Oh, I bought that.
Okay, cool. So that's like
a long time ago.
Parasites.
Yeah.
And that sort of predestined me for the grant that I have right now, which involves fleas, which I've never worked on before and went into this knowing nothing about. So that's another topic as well, I suppose.
Well, so that's kind of a good lead in, I think, to a question that I wanted to get at. You still identify as a beetle person, and did your postdoc and your other research on beetles.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I've encountered with grad students in particular, is that they think that their degree work is going to define their career path. I'm working on pollinators, and that is what I'm going to work on for the rest of my career. And obviously, like, you're still working on beetles, but you have posted photos of moths on Twitter.
Killed them. I heard a secret.
And you are okay. We'll cut that part.
You don't have to cut it. There's a I did an interview with Flora Lichtman from Every Little Thing, where at ESA a couple of years ago, where I gave her the impression that there's a deep and profound battle going on between lepidopterists and coleopterists, and we have nothing but disdain and hatred for each other. And I mean, for some, that's true. For some, it's a friendly rivalry, but we all know what the superior order of insects is, and it is coleoptera.
You're working on fleas now, and
yes.
Lice, maybe?
Not lice, just fleas.
No? Okay.
I posted a really cool picture of a louse that came up when I was looking for lice for, again, our exhibit where we're going to have some lice out in the hallway. We want to have every order of insect represented that we possibly can. And lice are something that were never represented before, so might as well get them in there too. The fleas is kind of a funny story. Do you want to hear the flea story?
I do, because I want to know, like, you're a beautiful person. Like, how do you work in this museum then, working on lots of things, like, especially having never worked on fleas? Like, how do you do that?
Well, there's two answers to that. One is that, again, prepared for this job by doing a PhD on the family Liotidae, which looks like this. This is a beaver beetle, Platycillus castoris. And the beaver beetle is a very flea-like or louse-like beetle that happens to be a fungus beetle, but it lives on beavers and it lives a flea-like lifestyle. So again, it all kind of comes together like sliding doors. But when I got here, I was being shown around the collection that was going to be my problem, ideally, for the rest of my life. And one of the other staff members who was showing me around said, over here is the flea collection. We have about 65,000 flea slides. They were donated by Dr. Robert Traub, who was one of America's preeminent flea researchers. He was at the Smithsonian, or affiliated with the Smithsonian as a research associate for a very long time. And when he retired, I'm told he wanted to retain his workspace there. And the folks at the Smithsonian said, no, we need that for people who are actual employees. And he said, well, give me some workspace or I'll donate my entire collection somewhere else. And apparently they said, try it. And so he called Dr. John Rollins, my predecessor, and said, hey, would you like 65,000 specimens of pinned fleas or of slide-mounted fleas? And Rollins said, yeah, sure, why not? And now we have this astonishing flea collection and Traub's entire library, all of his literature, all of his publications, and all of his personal, you know, reprint collection and all of that. It also turns out that we are running out of flea taxonomists at a horrifying pace. There are a few left in the States. There's Ralph Eckerland and Michael Hastritter. And those are the only ones that I know of. In terms of people who can identify fleas, who are describing new species of fleas, who are working on systematics and taxonomy, there are so few of them. They are vanishing. It's not a charismatic group. If you're going to do medical entomology and veterinary entomology, there may be more money for you in mosquitoes and ticks in terms of research funding. And so it seemed like fleas would be a perfect candidate to join this project called the Terrestrial Parasite Tracker. That is a thematic collections network project. That's an NSF-funded project to digitize and link data from insect collections all over the country. And so we have joined up with that. And we have an NSF grant now to capture as much of these fleas in digital format that can be shared on GBIF and elsewhere as possible. So I don't have to do flea taxonomy yet. I know it's coming. I know it's going to happen to me someday. But as of now, I don't have to identify fleas. We have all these fleas that have been identified by the expert in fleas. And so we're just trying to get them photographed, documented, and get that data online so that anyone around the world can find it. Because it might be 10 years from now, there might be only one working flea systematist or flea taxonomist left who speaks English.
We have a similar situation here with the frost in that we've got one of the best louse collections probably in the country. And same thing, like thousands, tens of thousands of specimens and nobody to work on it because nobody's an expert on it here. So we're on the same, well, Andy Deans is on the same project, and we digitize our lost collection that way. So yeah. That's really fun that we've got two really giant parasite collections like that. Just
yeah,
so close.
Yeah, we should be friends. We should think of a project we can do with that. It's so tempting because I'm not a really a bioinformatics person. I work with DNA sequence data from like little tiny baby Sanger sequencing reads. You know, I haven't gotten into genomics yet. I'm very old fashioned like that. But when I think about like bioinformatics and the possibilities for research doing a network analysis of these flea species, their host species, their geographic distribution. Like if you could capture all of that data, you could do phenomenal analyses. You could spend the rest of your career just analyzing that data set in different ways and publishing papers on it. And so it seems like it would really be of a huge advantage to everybody to get that data captured and digitized. So we'll see.
How close are you to getting it all done?
We've imaged every genus of flea that he had in the collection, which is about, I want to say, maybe 2/3 to 70% of the world's flea genera.
Wow.
And so that's a really good start. We are also trying to capture his data from his field logbooks. We've been transcribing those. That's been more challenging. I'm going to give a talk about this next month in Illinois, but part of the problem is that his field notes are not simply, I collected this flea from this mouse in Borneo in 1973. His notes are a list of every single mammal or bird that he touched to get fleas off of. And sometimes there weren't fleas on them and he wrote it down anyway. And so he has records of tens and tens of thousands of animals, but it'll be like, here's 17 different shrews that Robert Trow ruffled the fur of in 1965 and there were no fleas on them. Here's a bat that he touched. Here's a shrew that he poked. Here's a mole that he harassed. It didn't have a flea on it, but he wrote it down anyway. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with that information. It's presence data of that mammal host and absence data of a flea, but it's wild. I've heard some amazing stories about how to collect fleas in the first place. Some people will simply put the host in a Ziploc bag and shake it like a popcorn, you know, chicken or something. If you've got a
like
small
shake mammal. And bake, you mean?
Yeah, shake and bake. Yes.
Yeah. That's hilarious.
Or pick up your small mammal, like your squirrel or something, hold it over a sheet or a white piece of paper and drop it and the fleas will shoot off. If you've got something that's recently deceased with the beaver beetles, like as soon as it's dead, all the parasites are going to start hitting the road. And so you can grab them at that point. But we have fleas in our collection that we're collecting from like bears. How did they do that? Whose job was it to comb the bear? There's a whole story in there. That's what I like about the fleas is every single parasite has a little story about what unfortunate person had to collect what weird flea off of what horrible animal or other person, when and how. And I love that.
So something that I've been thinking about a little bit recently, I recently bought some seeds of American pitcher plants and I'm going to start these from seeds. And it's for a research project that I expect I probably won't publish on for 10 or more years because they take a while to mature. You know, being an early career person, I've never really done a project that long. Like you do a master's and you need to be wrapped up in 2 years. You do a PhD and you need to be wrapped up in 4, postdoc 1 to 6 or more. Early career stuff, you got to bang out projects to get publications so you can get tenure or promotion or whatever. And so I said something about, you know, this is the first long-term project I've ever done on Twitter. And Max Barclay, who I'm sure you know, responded just with this offhand comment that, like, come over to museum work because, yeah. You know, we're looking at these projects that are going to take my lifetime or 25 years or more. How do you, like, I guess, wrap your head around that or find motivation on a day-to-day basis? Like, it's going to take me 10 years to do this. How do I figure out what I'm going to do today? Like, what is...
Wait until you hear how long I've spent not publishing all of my PhD research. Ha ha ha. But there's just stuff that you do. The research, the priority that I have for research is what is funded. What do I have a grant to do that I have promised to deliver deliverables for? Do that first. Second, what am I doing in collaboration with other people that are expecting me to do my part of the project? Do that second. And then finally, the stuff where it's just me, which is 70% of what I do, that's always the last priority. So in terms of research projects, that's certainly a struggle. We are pretty good at maintaining a steady flow of undergraduates here. We have some really top-notch institutions of higher learning in Pittsburgh. And so we have a lot of undergrad volunteers, interns, work study students, and independent study students who come through. And if they have a project that they're going to do, that can often lead to a small publication. And then sometimes stuff pops up on Twitter. Sometimes Matt Bertone sees a weird beetle larva and hits me up on Twitter, and it turns into a little project and we get a great paper out of it. And so, you know, for me, if there's something that's going to get done that can be done collaboratively, that really helps. But in terms of the collection, like, this collection has buried so many curators before me, like, their ghosts linger on in their boxes and boxes of reprint collections that we don't really need, but no one can bring ourselves to throw away. Their correspondence is all still here. The first curator of entomology here was also the first director of the museum, William Jacob Holland. And he was the guy that Andrew Carnegie would telegram up and say, you know, ah, get me that Diplodocus. And Holland would say, yeah, sure. And he'd get on a train and go out to Utah and buy a Diplodocus for Andrew Carnegie, because that was his job. And he was a lepidopterist as well, right? And so we still have all of his correspondence. I can go look through a bound book of all of his letters, and they all say, "Dear Uncle Moneybags, please give us money." And then the next letter would say, "Dear Uncle Moneybags, thank you for the money that you gave us." And then he'd write another letter to a different Uncle Moneybags. And it was just, you know, dealing with donors, negotiating the purchase of collections, negotiating specimen transfers, that kind of thing. So there's a long history, and you just kind of slot into it and, you know, pitter-patter along until your time runs out. So you get kind of a feeling of timelessness, I guess. I think if we just set small goals, like, can I curate this group in the next 5 years? Can I curate that group in the next 2 years? And just kind of putter away surrounded by cool bugs at all times.
Those are life goals right there.
Can't complain. Yeah, it's something. There are things where, like, I know that there are some institutions where they've actually digitized their full collection, and I respect and admire that. We are not one of them. Our collection is really too big, and there's parts of it that we're still really just need basic curation, which is astonishing given how old it is. But it's just the attitude of some of the previous curators here was, habitat is endangered, the environment is threatened, so collect the bugs now and curate them later. And it turns out that curate them later means Ainsley curates them later and Kevin curates them later. And it is a problem for a future curator. So that's something that we're dealing with as well.
How many of those habitats, though, aren't there anymore?
Great question. If we digitized our collection, I could totally tell you.
Oh, no.
I will tell you, we have a lot of African material, and we have a ton of Indian material and a lot of Brazilian stuff as well. And that's really interesting, especially the Indian and Brazilian material, because it is not easy to set up a collecting trip from America to go to either of those countries these days. I know people have managed to do it, but it's pretty challenging. And so we're really lucky to have that kind of legacy material. And that's personally, for me, one of my top priorities is getting that stuff fully curated and sorted. A lot of it is papered Lepidoptera, which is one of the things that I hate most about Lepidoptera, which is when they're in little triangular paper envelopes and you can't see what's inside, and the outside maybe just says moth. And you open it up and it's something from a part of Brazil that's maybe been completely clear cut and paved by now. But you don't know because it's in its little paper envelope. So we're rehousing our paper Lepidoptera as the first major curatorial attack that I've made on this collection. So it's going pretty well, and I'm very excited about it.
What would you say to people who are collecting insects right now that really want to, like, transfer them to posterity so that they can save future Ainsley, Ainsley the Third, whoever will replace you in the future, like, how to save them some headaches?
Oh gosh, just put your data label in your insect specimen, because an insect specimen without a full data label is just a dead bug and we can't use it. often will have specimens, or worse yet, genitalia dissections that just have a four-digit number. What does that mean? Who can say? You have to find the field notebook that belonged to so-and-so. We have a vast collection of TC Barr's cave beetles here, and a lot of those are simply in a vial with a number, and you have to look up the number for that field work event in one of his many, many little handwritten ballpoint pen journals to say, oh, this is from Big Bear Butt Cave in Tennessee from 1967. And that's that tendency to save yourself, save current you some time by putting just a field code or a little color-coded piece of paper, or in the case of Henry Olkey, maybe a two-letter abbreviation for the place that you were with a certain dot put inside one of the letters to indicate what specific city in that state you are in. That's going to drive people completely insane down the line, and those people are going to be me.
So maybe think about who will be looking at what you are collecting and
label
what
it,
information.
Label it. No codes. Label the specimen. So that's my lazy way around this. As a graduate student, when I was doing most of my collecting, was to use vials, use 1.5 mil vials, put the beetles in the alcohol in the vials. And once you got back to a place with a printer, you print out the code, or you print out the label, or you write the full label data in micron pen or whatever, put it in the vial. And then whenever you pan or prep those specimens, you can put your printed labels on them. But label it. No codes. No field codes. No field codes ever.
We're going to have to break out the bleep machine, Mike. Make sure you charge the batteries.
I will. It's fine. You can swear as much as you want. It's colorful. It's, I'll just bleep it out.
I like it.
Nothing would bring me more joy.
As much as I would like to sort of maybe delve into the potential beef that exists between your museum and the National Museum of Natural History over a flea collection, I think that I wanted to explore this like moth versus beetles or beetles versus the world thing a little more. If I made you like lawyer for Coleoptera, you had to defend them from deletion, from Arthropoda or whatever, you know, God is deciding who gets to stay. What would you bring to the table if you were their Matlock? Like, how would you convince whatever all-powerful deity I have conjured up in this scenario why the beetles should be the ones to stay?
Well, first of all, I'm no city lawyer. I may be only a simple country coleopterist, but if I were to consider the case of beetles, I would first let you know that they're a superior insect because their incredible key innovation that makes them so diverse and species rich in the first place is that they can fold up their wings and put them away when they're not using them. I'm sorry, you're going to have to bleep that again, but they can fold up their wings and put them away under their elytra when they're not using them. Can moths do this? No, they cannot. If a moth doesn't need its wings, its only option is to either have wings that get beat up and totally ripped to shreds, or like some of these winter active moths, they have females that have no wings and they're just walking around looking like a fully nude hamster insect, and they can just walk everywhere and they can't fly. No good. No good at all. There's no defense. There's no mechanical defense. There's no shield. Their exoskeleton is soft and squishy. The people who study them have this horrendous problem where they really can't look at sclerotized characters of the exoskeleton because it's all covered with nasty scales. And when moths get into a trap, say a bucket trap, say a pitfall trap, an intercept trap, a malaise trap, you get nasty scales all over everything, over all of these perfectly good, self-respecting beetles. They come out covered with moth scales. Moths are disgusting. They litter scales all over everything. They are soft-bodied and squishy. Their wings are not protected. It's almost impossible to identify any of their really interesting little sclerotized characters. Their male genitalia are a huge pain in the ass to dissect and slide mount. They have weird mouth parts. They're untrustworthy. And frankly, they're just not as charming, as likable as your common everyday beetle. Beetles are good for children too. A child can pick up a beetle. A ladybug, a delicate ladybird, can walk across their little baby hand. It's so cute. They see a carabid or a tenebrion and they can pick it up. It's not going to bite them. It's not going to sting them. And they're not going to destroy it by gently picking it up. You pick up a butterfly, you get dust all over your hands. You've destroyed its wings. Congratulations. That butterfly is doomed to an early death because of you, small child. How do you like that? for the wonder of nature's beauty and majesty. So, I mean, a hissing cockroach is good too. I consider it an honorary beetle.
Okay. But
in terms of interaction and, you know, sort of an insect you can pick up, consider, look at, hold in your hands, move from place to place, beetles superior in every way.
How do you defeat the Hemiptera in this scenario?
Well, for starters, we have a good set of opposed chewing mouth parts, a nice set of mandibles, which are fun to work with, and a really important set of, I would say, characters, recent morphological systematics and taxonomy. The Hemiptera are also known for being really unpleasant pests. They're really important plant pests, and they're also pests of humans. Things like bed bugs. Is there a beetle that comes into your bed and bites you while you sleep? There's not. And we all know what bed bugs do when it comes to reproduction. I'm not going to get into that on a family podcast, but you've got your kissing bugs. You've got your rejuviids. They all they want to do, a bellus stomata. What does it want to do? It wants to grab you, a vertebrate, bite you, and inject you with a proteolytic enzyme that melts your flesh from the inside out and slurp that flesh up through their nasty feeding tube like a slurry, like a meat milkshake. That's what you are to hemipterids. Beetles aren't going to do that to you.
Make a very compelling case.
Thank you.
I think we will select Coleoptera. Granted, they get to live.
Well, if God himself came down and said, which insect is the best? The obvious answer is, as Haldane reminds us, that God already has an inordinate fondness for Coleoptera. So true. Does the case of it need to be made? It's already there.
Proclivity is already there.
It also brings me great joy to antagonize other entomologists of all kinds.
Yeah, I'm sure we won't get any mail about this.
Lepidopterists, clearly. Dipterists. I made an entire t-shirt antagonizing dipterists. So
we had an orthopterist on recently, and they sound like the mafia. So I would be happy for you to defeat them.
Who was that?
Joe Von Hill.
Okay. I'll have to listen to that one. That's fantastic. Now, I only know about four orthopterists, and they seem like a fascinating group. But again, they're okay, I guess, but again, they're kind of soft body. They can't fold their wings that well. They make people think that the CIA is putting mind control devices in Cuban embassies when it's just a cricket that's yelling really loud. Do you guys have a whole podcast episode about the CIA Cuban crickets? Because I think that's a really important topic.
I'm going to put that on the list. Yeah.
I think that should be one of our scripted episodes for the year.
Or is that platforming the conspiracy theory?
It's platforming the orthopterists.
Oh, there we go.
Cricket. It's just a cricket. It's a cricket that makes a noise so awful that you think that you're losing your mind, that you think that a sonic weapon is being aimed at your very own tympanum because this cricket is so horrible to listen to.
I don't often hand out podcast points or podcast guest points, but you do get a million of them for pretending to snap your suspenders and putting on a Southern accent. So thank you.
I conclude my
the defense rests. Mike, did we get what you wanted out of the curation portion? Have we delved into this the way you hoped? I don't think you anticipated this part, probably.
No, it's fine, though. I do have to admit, I experienced a bit of PTSD when you mentioned moth scales and malaise traps, because a big portion of my master's work was taking malaise traps and sieving them so I could look for the mites.
So
it was nothing but butt moth scales, sample of moth scales to sort through for the mites.
That's awful.
But then we had a nice clean malaise trap because I'd clean everything off under the sink through the sieve. So all the other specimens were very nice.
That with mites, God, you'd have to do, there's a guy named Matt Buffington.
I know Matt, yeah.
Yeah, who he and the other microhymenopterists actually published a method that they devised for fractionating belays and other samples to get the tiny little wasps to float up to the top. So just like you would take a sample of blood and spin it in a centrifuge to get the plasma at the top and the cells at the bottom, you put your fluid, you know, preserved trap sample into a Tupperware and then put it on a shaker in the laboratory. And if you shake it for long enough at the correct frequency, all of the wasps will self-assort by size. And it's actually a brilliant method. And I don't know if that would work for mites and Lepidoptera scales, but now I'm really curious.
That is very cool. I unfortunately have not managed to get back to mites, so I probably can't test it anytime soon.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. I did want to wrap up asking about the curation stuff. just by asking about the museum in general. So you've mentioned it's fairly sizable and it goes back quite a ways in history. But we haven't talked about the collection. So how big is the Carnegie collection and what are the strengths of it? Like, what do you have lots of specimens of?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'll just say something really quick. You said you haven't had a lot of museum folks in your podcast before. It took me a while to kind of figure this out, but museums often have strengths. And when you are figuring out what museums you need to visit, if you're a taxonomist or a systematist, it'll often be based on what museums have strengths in your collection area. And I've actually never come to this museum to use specimens for a research purpose until I moved here for a job, because all of the things that I needed to use for my research were all at the Field Museum, because Al Newton and Margaret Thayer were the ones who were working on South Temperate Southern Hemisphere Staphylinoidea, and that was my group. And so I only needed to go there and then to the actual Southern Hemisphere countries I was doing field work in. But the strengths here are, I would say, carabid beetles, for sure. That's thanks to the efforts of Bob Davidson and his collaborators. We have the largest collection, I believe, in the world of Manticora, which is the extremely metal giant black tiger beetle. I think it's the largest tiger beetle species in the world. They are unutterably cool, and I love them. Massive amount of tiger beetles, extraordinary collection of Diplodidae. Crane flies, huge moth holdings, extraordinary moth holdings, especially from the tropics, from the neotropics, from Africa, a decent amount of European material that was getting imported in the late 19th century. And then a very, very well curated general beetle collection. Oh, we have one of the largest sphingid collections. If you are in Pittsburgh, from Pittsburgh, or talk to somebody associated with Pittsburgh, they might let you know that The Silence of the Lambs was filmed here and in part in Ohio. I think they filmed the really gross, nasty parts in Ohio and the cool, awesome parts in Pittsburgh. And there's a museum scene filmed right here in our museum in the one of the oldest Lepidoptera room in the insect collection, where Jodie Foster walks in to interview some weird entomologists to identify a sphingid pupa. So I don't know if it was selected because of our sphingid holdings, but it was certainly a natural advantage. And the blinds that we have in that room are still the same blinds that Jonathan Demme, the director of that movie, bought for us to make it look spooky and atmospheric in there.
Why let them go to waste?
So that's our holdings is beetles and leps. And the remit of this museum has always been bugs and bones. We have other lesser things like mammals and birds and some plants, but the bugs and bones, the butterflies and the dinosaur fossils that's what people come to see. That's what we have the most of. And it's been like that since 1895.
I've never heard of the Carnegie referred to as bugs and bones, and I am only going to refer to it as that from now on, because I like that tagline.
You could probably say that about any natural history museum of this particular vintage. There was a real craze. I tell people it was the Pokemon of its day. There was a craze for collecting Lepidoptera back, Nabokov and before, the generations of aristocratic or otherwise not very gainfully employed young men who had time on their hands and money that would get into collecting butterflies, collecting moths, some collecting beetles if they were people of exquisite tastes, but it was really a widespread hobby. And so that, I feel, kind of fed this collection. It fed this sort of public fascination with insects and butterflies. And a lot of people, who are fond of that stuff, they get into it and then they die and their family says, what do we do with all of these stinking bugs that are in our house? They would often leave the collection to us. And we actually have some really charismatic specimens from the Victorian era, things like big Ornithoptera, those big, green and black butterflies from the Pacific, that have been donated. And someone went through, I think Sue Swadener, one of our previous curators, went through and made these little typewritten notes that are pinned to the butterflies in the collection that say, I think that this donor fudged this locality because I know this species doesn't occur there. Or I think that, they say that this species was collected here, but I'm pretty sure they just bought it from this guy and he only collected there. And so it's like this little kind of section of little sort of catty remarks about bad curation habits and people who maybe got swindled out of some money because they thought they were buying a rarer butterfly than it really was. the idea of people just buying bugs for a collection for fun is kind of insane to me. I understand that just collecting is something people enjoy. Everybody has a collection of something, and that's fine. But to me, I mean, I live in a collection. I work in a collection every day. My entire life is going to be a collection. And if I'm lucky, I'll be in here until I finally go to my great reward and they pin me and put me in the back of the moth section. But it's a, you know, I don't understand the point of mail ordering a bunch of bugs just to put them in your house and be like, well, these are my bugs that I have. Here they are. And that's a really interesting impulse to me. And I'm sure you could find a lot of people who would be happy to write you a nasty email about why collecting is great and I'm bad and wrong. But
we'll direct those to you. Wouldn't pinning you in the moth collection like incur your wrath for forever? Wouldn't you be a ghost?
Probably that, my eventual ghost would definitely be haunting the whole situation. Like
I've covered in scales.
Exactly. Horrible. leaving a little trail of Noctua dust behind me wherever I go. Noctura, the really gross ones.
Please put that in the comic book you mentioned before.
Well, the dark truth is I'd probably be point mounted rather than pinned, but just for personal preference. But yeah, no, it's a great collection. It's powerful. And I really hope that we can do everything we can to kind of connect it with the greater research community. It really wasn't before. I feel like there was not a great presence for this collection at things like meetings and get-togethers. There were individual members might be tapped into Diptera Society or Lepidoptera Society. But one of my goals is kind of to help raise the public profile and the profile in the entomological community of our collection and our museum.
I think the work you're doing there is great. I just love you. I listened to episode 8 this morning. I loved it.
Oh, so, I'm terrified.
I don't have much to say because I'm like, I really like her. And I'll sit and stare and listen because I had so much fun. Like, you just kept going on and on. And it just kept getting better and better. And I was like, I just can't wait to like hear like that. It had been 8 years, but you're still so fascinating. And I think
keep going on and on.
But I loved it. It's not like a lot of people here, they go on and on. And I leave or I shut my door. I was pretty excited. So I'm just taking it all in, listening to you. And I think the legacy that you'll leave there is just so great. I think with the stories that you're seeing, the notes you're finding, history, like these are all such great stories that you can tell and you're sharing. And like you have such a great purpose and impact. From all your social media and talking with us and talking to whoever. So you're just doing such a great job. So I appreciate like you spending time with us today. Well, you can say all the bad words you want. We'll just bleep it out or not.
I am like life-threateningly flattered, but I will exchange it. I'm going to extend an invitation to anyone who's listening to this. If you would like to come to the Carnegie Museum of Natural History and come look at our collection, look at our cool bugs. We have lots and lots of space for visiting researchers and anyone who wants to help curate or come look at stuff that might be of interest to them. We do lots of loans to folks who would like to identify members of their particular group and maybe see if there's specimens they want to use. So we're a very, very active collection. We did not shut down during the pandemic, and we are very friendly people who are always ready to welcome you into our bosom like an antlion, but with less death. So
even if you like Lepidoptera.
Even if you like Lepidoptera, you're really going to like it here. I say with regret.
Well, Ainsley, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it as well. I think this has been a great interview and I hope the listeners enjoy it. John, I always forget how we roll this thing out. So can you do the website?
You don't look for us on the internet. You don't do the Kanye thing and listen to yourself.
Yeah, I don't remember what it is. Blogspot.com, something.
If the listeners want to find our show notes where we will have some cool information from Dr. Seago highlighting her museum and her work, you can find that at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. The show is also on Twitter. We are arthro_podshow. Each of the hosts is also on Twitter. I am on that platform at BugmanJohn.
I'm probably banned, but I'm at JodyBugsMeUNL.
I'm at mscavarla36. And Ainsley, where can the people find you?
I'm American Beatles on Twitter.
That's so much better than my handle.
It's just the title of the book that was next to my computer when I signed up for Twitter.
Amazing. I assumed it was because you were an American working on Beatles in Australia.
Also correct. I had a secret live journal where I used to post comics called Australian Beatles that I'm pretty sure is defunct now. But yeah, it turns out there's also other people in America who like and work on Beatles, but it's too late for them because I've got that Twitter handle and I'm not going to look
it. You've got it locked down.
Locked down the trademark.
So it's me versus Bax Barclay, who has claimed coleopterist.
He should have done UK Beatles or something.
The only one that globally he is coleopterist. So, oh well, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? Probably tune into the next episode of Arthropod, which will come to you in a couple of weeks. We hope you enjoyed this one. Shoot us any ideas you got for shows. Leave us a rating and review. It's always very helpful. And we'll catch you then and there.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
You hear that, Mike? It's called a segue.